Hello everyone, namaste and welcome to another edition of the Bharat Vartha Weekly. We have Nirav Kanodra and Prasanna Vishwanathan here with Roshan Karyappa to bring you the news and events from the week that was. It was a pretty somber week, I should say. The Russia-Ukraine war continues and we're going to bring you developments on that front. Also, you know, we're continuing to evacuate Indians from the war zone. There's also an impending fuel price hike that is expected. The stock market crashed last week, and if that, all of that was not bad enough, I mean, we also had the tragic news of cricketer Shane Warne passing away. As usual, we will bring you, we'll talk about the couple of episodes that we put out last week. So last week, one of the episodes was with Bruno Macias, who, of course, I mean, he's been pretty famous or infamous, I should say, on Indian Twitter for all of his comments on, you know, what we should do and should not do and stuff like that. But thankfully, on this episode, I mean, he kind of focused on the European response, the American response, and he covered some of the geopolitical significance of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. One thing that I got is that, you know, I mean, people are taking it super seriously, at least in Europe, right? I mean, I think that that post-Cold War lull has been shaken, clearly. You know, plenty of nuances were discussed, very amazingly marshaled by Velina Chakrova, of course. So do check out that podcast with Bruno Macias on all of the geopolitical significance and nuances of the Russia-Ukraine war. Also, we put out a very interesting episode with Rajat Sexeria, who's the CEO of Acme Cleantech, which is one of the largest, you know, companies in the renewable sector. Nirav, what do you think about this episode?
Yeah, hi. So I think it was a fantastic episode. So not just talking about like the hydrogen policy, where it is designated towards like the clean, so the green hydrogen, instead of just having a hydrogen policy, which the West has. So that because he discussed all the different sources of hydrogen. So green, blue, gray, as well as pink, which comes from, say, nuclear power. And not just differences between zero carbon by 2050 and 2070. So I think both are episodes on clean energy, one with Jayant Sinha and one with Vaibhav Chaturvedi had also spoken about this. And the way he mentioned that India going net zero by 2070 allows Indian energy producers to actually sell carbon credits. So even if India reaches by 2050, this helps us finance our transition to cleaner energy. And how the transition to hydrogen also is for energy security, because all the hydrocarbon-based energy is being imported, right? So oil is being imported. So instead of that, if we transition towards a hydrogen fuel-based system. So I think it's a very interesting episode. He talks right from like high school chemistry, going all the way into like policy. So totally enjoyable.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that struck me was the grasp of the micro details, you know, at the highest levels of the government is just insane. You know, the nuance that you mentioned, saying green hydrogen instead of just hydrogen is again, I mean, something that's mind-boggling, really. And I never thought that I would have an hour plus discussion on energy policy, etc. Right? I mean, sounds very dry and everything, but Rajat speaks really well, very insightful and very entertaining also, I would say, right? Some of the examples, anecdotes and stuff. So do check out these couple of episodes for sure. All right, we'll begin with some updates on the Russia-Ukraine war. Last week, Russia declared a temporary ceasefire in the Ukrainian cities of Mariupol and Volnovakha to allow civilians to leave. However, this ceasefire was violated by Russia and over 350 civilians were killed in shelling attacks. Russian forces also attacked Europe's largest nuclear power plant and set it on fire, raising alarm globally over concerns of another Chernobyl-like incident. Putin also made a statement warning that any nation contemplating imposing a no-fly zone over Ukraine would be considered by Moscow to be participating in, to quote, armed conflict. To this end, NATO refused to police a no-fly zone over the country, warning that such a move could provoke war. I think this week, the situation has gotten a lot more real. So what do you think, Prasanna? I mean, any comments on what has happened over the last week?
I think, yeah, just like you mentioned, you know, the way in which it has unfolded seems quite a dangerous spiral, right? No signs of any imminent ceasefire or any, you know, possibilities of the cessation of hostilities. Just read this morning that the Israeli Prime Minister is trying to play the peacemaker, made a visit to Putin, and then from there he went and met Chancellor of Germany. So we've not heard about it. I'm not sure what is going to be the de-escalation option for Putin, which can be seen as a, you know, where he could also claim victory and, you know, even the West can also say that, you know, they were able to, you know, quote unquote, stop the expansionist designs of Putin. So I think this gets getting really messier and deadlier. You know, you saw the way in which the Russians, I think initially they were quite mindful of the fact that they didn't want to really inflict huge civilian casualties. So the military strategy seems to be a little careful and calibrated in terms of not actively trying to provoke the Ukrainian population. But I think like that kind of, I think, lend itself to a very concerted propaganda by the Western media, academia, that Russia is facing a serious setback and, you know, basically they failed in the military objective and all that. But I think last 2-3 days, you've seen a shift in the Russian strategy where they've been a little more, you know, they've been relentlessly pounding some of these key Ukrainian cities. So I really don't see what is going to be the end game, any end game, at least in the short term, right? I mean, it is bound to get worse before maybe it can get better. Any solution to end this conflict without potentially recognizing Russia's influence in the neighborhood and, you know, like some kind of scaling down of NATO ambition, I see it very difficult how we could find a solution with it. You know, like, and Putin also, to some extent, it's a single party authoritarian state, right? So say if it's a very noisy, polarized democracy, there is a certain public opinion element, domestic public opinion, which plays out, right? And the leader needs to be mindful of the public opinion and calibrate positions. But in Russia, I think like Putin has the, you know, the luxury of pursuing his vision or militarist vision to its logical end, right? Like he's also emboldened by his previous experiences where the annexation of Crimea, you know, except for some sanctions which were mere pinpricks, he was able to ride over it. This time, of course, we need to be mindful of the fact that the Western countries, EU, US alliance has much more punitive sanctions, you know, which, I mean, even if you could sympathize with or, you know, kind of see a point of view in what Putin is pursuing, I think this level of coordinated sanctions that the West and, you know, the larger West has imposed on Russia, I think, is going to be certainly cause, you know, serious economic pain to Russia. You know, though Russia has kind of gamed scenarios since 2014 to build that internal endurance to withstand any of these any of these potential sanctions. I really don't see the ability of a middling economy. See, Russia is like a military superpower, but its economic clout is slightly limited, right? So I don't know its ability to kind of withstand this level of sanctions that West has done, especially in a very concerted, coordinated way. And I think the economic impact is what is going to be, maybe Nirav can add a little more, but I think it's going to be quiet. When we just thought that, you know, countries are kind of, COVID is behind us, and then, you know, the next 2 years, country can focus on the growth that was lost over the last 2-3 years across the world. This is unfolding, and I think this has a serious potential to disrupt the global economic system. And, you know, this kind of an inflection point where a lot of countries might look at the option where, you know, this kind of order, quote unquote, which the prevalent world order might collapse, and we might move to a much more multilateral, regional power-centric kind of a model, right? And a lot of countries might even come to a conclusion that, you know, this might not be a bad thing, though it could mean a certain disruption, right? And economically, you know, the fact that, you know, so many things, for instance, you know, if you really look at the food prices, right? Like between Russia and Ukraine, they control 30% of the exports of wheat, actually, especially countries like Egypt and Turkey, right? Like they don't have food security like India. For instance, India is not a very big exporter, but they do have a huge domestic wheat production, right, as a part of our food security plan. But Turkey and Egypt, you know, they spend like exorbitant sums to import wheat from Russia and Ukraine. And some of the ports, you know, the grain ports Especially in Ukraine, I think it's completely, I don't see any export activity ever happening in any time soon. Russia does have, just because of the sheer geographic expanse of Russia, I think they do have certain ports from which they can still send grain produce and all that. But again, you know, the shipping companies are also, even private shipping companies, you know, I mean, other than almost all the big oil is withdrawing their investment. Some of it, I think, is virtue signaling, but some of them are okay writing off their investment in Russia. Food, I think the food security of some of these countries, if they get impaired, you know, what are going to be the domestic political consequences for those countries, right? And then, of course, the entire energy issue, which you also alluded that you had a detailed discussion, you know, like still the kind of dependence that Europe has. And they even consciously built it over the last decade as well. You know, how that is going to play out in terms of the global energy prices, actually. I mean, I think oil is still okay. I think like, but in terms of the gas, right? I think like the kind of stranglehold that Russia has over Europe. I mean, I don't think so. There is any short-term mitigation measures. Like you can't say a US or a Qatar can't really step in and kind of provide that, meet the demand in the short term, at least, you know, like, and especially, you know, the Germany's own energy strategy of denuclearizing, you know, and of course, coal is not even in the mix. Embrace of the green energy is like a medium to long-term project, right? Actually, so like, and the gas supplies are all built through pipelines, you know, like they don't even have sufficient LNG terminals in Germany, you know, like in fact, I just read that they are now accelerating the development of two LNG projects, which were put on the back burner due to environmental regulatory rules and all, and suddenly they've woken up and trying to build that infrastructure. So, you know, there's nothing like where they can get away from Russian reliance in the short term, at least on the gas market, actually. So, you know, the implications. And of course, for India, I think the military hardware dependence, you know, is very stark. So, longer the war is going to go, I think it's going to be very bad for the world economy.
So, just adding there, so few things which I want to highlight. I think no matter what the outcome, who wins the war, I think Ukraine is the loser. They've released a lot of prisoners who are taking up arms. They are calling in for other people to come and join the war. It's not unlike, like, say, Russian invasion of Afghanistan and the Taliban being formed. What might happen is you have all these armed, they are getting arms from Europe, but not troops. So you get a ragtag bunch of these fighters is probably a creation of like a Ukrainian Taliban, or so may not even be on religious lines, but like local warlords. So the crime and the whole situation. So in for a short-term gain, I think long-term, I am very, I would say, bearish or like very upset. So that is one thing. Two is, in this conflict, we are seeing kind of like all these sanctions being put on, like a pariah state, that Russian aircrafts cannot be insured, Russian ships cannot be insured. So you cannot fly into or out of Russia. Now probably only say via China or like a neutral country like India, you might be able to fly to Russia. So those are the issues. So it kind of alienates the Russian population from the rest of the world. We've seen sanctions in Iran and Venezuela recently, and South Africa much earlier. The sanctions don't like lead to an immediate stoppage, right? Because South Africa under sanctions also lasted quite long. It started off with cricket in the 70s, but only in the 80s did the economic sanctions get stronger and stronger. And then with Russia being, as Prasanna pointed out, right? Russia being a very big energy exporter, right now, like from public news, but natural gas prices are so high that while for heating it is being used, fertilizer plants are being shut. And so what that leads to is like fertilizer prices go up, or like lower amount of fertilizer is used. So that leads to higher agri prices. Ukraine can't export wheat. Maybe, this is just again, my own personal opinion. India has a lot of stock in FCI. India could try and sell some of its stock, because we have over 2 years of stock. And through COVID, all our production has been continuous, right? We never shut down agriculture. So we have enough energy security. If India could try and sell wheat in the public market, or at least so helps with the humanitarian situation across the world, right? So that is also one thing. There are so many complicated parts, it's such a complex system. We don't really know what are the second and third order effects. Higher energy prices can lead to higher resentment. We have elections coming up in France, as you mentioned, like in Turkey and Egypt, if food prices go up. We had Arab Spring, the last time food prices spiraled up higher, right? So it's an all out negative for almost all the parties concerned. Thankfully, India is like very far away from it. India gets affected by higher fuel prices, which probably India can manage. It'll lead to some sort of a slowdown. India did a good thing on raising fuel taxes earlier, so maybe we can cut a bit of that. We'll talk about that later. And also has a very large buffer of FX reserves. So I think that is fine. But in the immediate periphery, I think the biggest loser is Ukraine. Doesn't matter whether Russia gains or loses. Ukraine surely has lost. This is a war between West and Russia. And biggest loser is Ukraine. And US is again like a little more insulated, being far away. Europe is another loser of this because of energy. It's all in all quite a bad thing. Hopefully we see some sort of a resolution. Prime Minister of Israel is going and trying to arrange talks. That's all what I can say.
Yeah, I mean, only one point just to add to Nirav, that when Putin launched the military operation, right? Like he used this word called denazification, right? Demilitarization and denazification. Initially, I thought that it's just a rhetorical flourish, right? Like because over the years, you know, that particular word Nazism is almost kind of, you know, bandied about so casually to kind of, you know, characterize anybody whose political view is not palatable to you or something like that. Sad, because it's a word with a serious import, right? Given that, you know, I was very surprised that since Nirav just mentioned this point of this ragtag militia, privately armed groups and all. I mean, the phenomenon of neo-Nazism, right, in Ukraine is quite alarming, in the sense that I think after 2014, the way in which the Ukrainian, in anticipation of, you know, any Russian adventurism, I think like they've kind of co-opted all these neo-Nazi groups into the larger military apparatus, you know, and some of these neo-Nazi groups are like, see, even if you even look at Western Europe, right, like say some of these countries, Britain, Germany, and all, they are on the real fringe, right, of the political or the spectrum, right? Like, I mean, probably they might be more vocal on social media through anonymous accounts and all that, but from a real political or even influence, right, they are very marginal. But it seems that is not the case in Ukraine, right? Like they see they are quite influential and, you know, openly flaunting symbols of Nazism and, you know, the cultural symbols and all that stuff, which is quite alarming. You know, of course, Putin might be building a case for his own expansionist plans, but the real danger that Nirav points out is that, you know, let's even assume that there is a cessation of hostilities and then there is some kind of a uneasy calm that prevails. But this entire thing of co-opting private groups, in fact, I think a lot of cities, Ukrainian government under the Zelensky, I think they openly signed agreements to even allow them to guard cities, infrastructure and all that, you know, and like once you lose control of these private groups with access to arms and all that, you know, I mean, of course, West seems to be, though they are not directly putting foot soldiers on the ground or boot on the ground, but they seem to be kind of building up some of these capabilities, right? And if all these arms end up with these kind of groups, right, I think this entire situation would not be very good, right, over the long-term thing. So I think, as Nirav perfectly summed up, I think, you know, Ukraine's prospects I think like it could have easily thrived and survived as a kind of a neutral power, right, which stands between Russia and the West. It could have actually leveraged both the West as by versus Russia by kind of, you know, being a little more concentrated. But I think in the last 3-4 years, the kind of, you know, lot of it is actually linked to the domestic politics of US as well. From there, I think this entire thing is kind of emboldened the Ukrainian, you know, leaders to kind of make this extremist, I mean maximalist position, right, with little scope for negotiation and nuance. And I think this is where we at the end of all this.
So a couple of follow-up questions to whatever you guys said, right? So one is, what is the end game? Himang Palan mentions on YouTube, the end game seems to be like replacing the Russia regime, basically replacing Putin. Is that the case? And the second question that I had was, so can you consider this like a World War III? Or will this escalate to a World War III?
Yeah, right, how it unfolds. I really, World War III, even this full-scale, quote-unquote, the invasion of Ukraine was something that was kind of unthinkable, I would say, two months back. I mean, I mean, even a lot of us who kind of are not invested in one way or other in this conflict, right? We did think that the repeated alerts from the Western intelligence is more like care-mongering and all that. But here we are where, you know, Putin has kind of acted on his threat, right? So how would... So there is no way of predicting the trajectory of this war, you know, and as I said, my only concern is that Western political system, right, you know, the way at which, see, this war, right, I mean, maybe they, in a cynical way, kind of suits the political agenda of the incumbents in both US and UK to some extent, I would say. See, you know, the in the last 2-3 months have been pretty bad for Biden himself in terms of his domestic political rating with the energy prices up and all that stuff. So we have historically seen that US presidents have looked at overseas conflicts as a way of rallying domestic political opinion, right? So usually may US, I mean, even that has kind of changed in the US, but at least a decade back, right, there used to be a fair degree of consensus on foreign policy intervention, right? I mean, of course, I think that consensus is broken now because the domestic, there's, I think, a significant section of US, you know, public, which seems like extremely tired of these endless wars waged by the establishment. Cheerled by establishment of both the political persuasions, right? Except that Trump was a kind of a brief distraction to this project. I mean, in the sense, you know, I don't know whether he did it as a part of a disruption or it is just the way it was just a personality factor, right? But again, it's now come back to the normal, right? Like where you see the establishment of both the Republicans as, I mean, of course, the Democrats are ruling. They seem to be always cheerleading any of these wars using, you know, very high-sounding, moralistic fervor to any of these military interventions.
Coming to the two questions. So one is, even if Putin is replaced, say internally or some oligarchs decide to depose him, we may or may not see a pro-Western leader in Russia, right?
Yeah.
They are also going to. So I don't think it solves that problem. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. The thing is, now the total variance of all outcomes is super wide, according to me. So you cannot even imagine, it goes beyond like a lot of calculations. So what does that happen? Is there a pro-China leader over there, etc.? We have no idea. Second thing is this the start of World War III? You can draw parallels between World War I actually, and this thing, where economy-wise, to be fair, Russia is 1.5 trillion. That's about half of India's GDP. Ukraine is much smaller. It's twice per capita GDP of India, about $4,000, and just 45 million people, right? So these are like two middle-income countries at edge of Eastern Europe fighting over, right? It was like Austro-Hungarian Empire and Serbia. And people thought that conflict would end up soon. And then because of all the treaties that they had signed and each one aligned, because Prince of Austro-Hungarian Empire was killed in Serbia, they declared war on Serbia. So Russia had a treaty with Serbia, then Germany had a treaty with Austro-Hungarian Empire, and then it kept spiraling out. Even Turkey versus Greece, they took opposite sides because of like some allies, right? It was all, as in Hindi, you would call it, dushman ka dushman dost. And this spiraled out. We have nuclear weapons now. And I don't think, while you may not see military warfare, but you might see the world splitting into, you might see the world splitting into two economic zones. With the sanctions kind of trying to kneecap Russia, say one obvious example is China has $3 trillion equivalent of FX reserves, and $1 trillion is in US government debt, right? So maybe they will try and diversify away from it. Again, I have no insight into this. I'm just speculating. So what we might see is two different trading blocks, like what started in Stalin's Russia. So you have like, it may be Cold War 2.0 rather than World War III. I think, in my opinion. But as I said, variance of outcomes is just too huge.
Last point is that I think like, unless US kind of decides seriously to get involved, right? I think it can be still a localized conflict with, like what Nirav said, a worldwide economic implication. And I hope that, see, in the 30s and 40s, right, I think that isolationism, see, geographically, US is isolated, which secures itself, right? And there is always this very strong streak of what you call the America first, and let's keep away from being the global failure. I think in the early 20th century, this streak was the very... was a dominant strand in the American thinking, right? Still, till they kind of decided to plunge into the World War II after the provocation from Japan and all that. So hopefully, if the domestic public opinion in the US is kind of, you know, wary of wars and puts some kind of pressure on the leaders there not to do silly things, especially since it's a nuclear-armed country, which we are talking about as the, you know, the focal point of this particular escalation. You know, I think that is the only thing we can count on where hopefully it doesn't really escalate into anything which, you know, characterizes a world war or something like that.
The Ministry of External Affairs has brought back nearly 4,000 Indians from Ukraine over the weekend. However, a total of 1,000 Indians are still stranded in Kharkiv, Sumy regions. MEA spokesperson Arindan Bakshi said 16 flights are scheduled for evacuation of stranded Indians in the next 24 hours. Speaking in a statement, Putin claimed that the students were being held hostage in Ukraine. However, Bakshi stated that the Indian embassy in Ukraine is in continuous touch with the nationals and no such hostage situation was reported. The Indian embassy in Ukraine on Thursday advised all Indian nationals in Kharkiv to fill an online form on urgent basis as the Russian onslaught on the city continued. Well, we're seeing different types of videos on social media, etc., from various sources. But one thing is that I think it's an all hands on deck situation from an external ministry perspective, right? I mean, what do you make of the evacuation efforts? I think in comparison to, let's say, China and so on, we seem to have more of a concerted effort, right?
Yeah. So I think first is, see, we had about 20,000 odd people in Ukraine, and out of which, all apart from the ones in Kharkiv or Kharkiv and the Russian border have been evacuated from Ukraine to like either Poland or Romania, right? And then after, from those 18,000-19,000 who are outside, we've brought back 4,000 already to India. The rest are coming in batches. Each plane probably gets about 200-ish people. So I think that's a very good positive thing. India has decent relationship with Russia. So from Kharkiv, probably the way for Indian students is to go towards Russia, in fact, and be evacuated from there. India, by abstaining, this is would have been one of the calculations in their mind also, apart from the security for weapons, of abstaining from anything with Russia, right? You have to try and be neutral. India does not have a horse in this race. Doesn't matter who wins. India should be bothered about its own citizens and how it affects its own economy, right? So less of virtue signaling. I think what Indian government has done has been a fantastic job. There have been a few cases where there have been videos where people are saying that, some Ukrainian soldiers were misbehaving with Indians, or some people were complaining about like the facilities, what they had in the temporary camps or whatever you may call it, right? It was Spartan, but it's not a five-star hotel. You're not paying for it. It's you're being evacuated in a wartime emergency. And if you have to clean the toilets, which you yourself have used, so that the next batch can use it, the next people who come in can use it, right? I think that is just bare minimum decency expected. Agreed that the videos going viral on social media, a lot of them are still kids, late teens or early 20s. So maybe I give it to their immaturity. But I frankly think this is a fantastic job by India. Yeah. And given whatever resources we have, it's all our hands on deck. Ministry of External Affairs, our Civil Aviation Ministry, Air India, which is now in private hands, Tata Airlines, right? Or Air India as owned by Tata. They are all working together and trying and moving everyone back. The External Affairs Ministry, our embassy in Ukraine is proactive. Our embassy in Russia is proactive. Same thing with Poland and Romania, right? I think Hungary is also not taking refugees from Ukraine, if what I heard correctly. So I think that border is sealed off. But we have alternate points. And I think it's a fantastic job. It shows state capacity. And this is a time to be united and kind of be for your nation. Other countries probably have fewer citizens as well. There have been reports of
about 3,000
African students kind of facing a lot of racism. Even if Indians do face racism, it doesn't matter. Be thick-skinned. In 2-3 days, you'll be out. They are in so far, 4,000 have been evacuated. I think 18-19 will be evacuated. And from Kharkiv to Russia might take a bit longer. We've had one death. and some were injured. But hopefully, Indian students waving a white flag, or they're allowed to move out in a ceasefire time zone, whatever it is. Hopefully, that is done well. And yeah, I think Putin also has a working relationship with Prime Minister Modi. And I think these all considerations will help. So yeah, that's all that I can say.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I don't know. I mean, this has to be said, right? I mean, that the first priority in a war is to get the hell out alive, right? I mean, the rest of it can wait. Well, in some unfortunate news, cricket icon Shane Warne has passed away at the age of 52. The cricketer was found unresponsive in his villa and is suspected to have succumbed to a heart attack. An iconic name in international cricket, he played 145 tests for Australia since making his debut in 92. He picked up 708 wickets in tests and 293 wickets in ODIs. He was the second highest wicket taker in test history, second only to Sri Lankan off-spinner Muthiah Muralidharan. His leg spin was the stuff of legend, helping his nation win the World Cup in 99. After retiring from international cricket, Warne added to his career by doubling up as a captain and coach of IPL team Rajasthan Royals. Well, the Royals had a very sweet message, in fact, yesterday on Twitter, really emotional message and stuff. I think one of the sad things of growing up is to watch your heroes or watch your icons pass away, right? But even so, I think Warne, gone too soon, I would say, right? Just in his early 50s. And what a character. I mean, person was known for more than his cricket. Such an amazing personality and a good commentator also, if I may add, right? I mean, some of his stuff... I mean, he had a very good vibe and stuff, right? So yeah, guys, what do you think?
For me, I actually remember Shane Warne's first test. I did not have cable TV in my house. So the game was in Sydney and Ravi Shastri scored a 200, Sachin scored a 150, and Australian fast bowler Bruce Reid was injured. And Shane Warne gave 150 runs for the wicket of Ravi Shastri, actually, right? After that game, most people would have been dropped and, you know, would have been sidelined. But it just shows his mental strength, like what he had. And he did bulk of the bowling with one bowler injured. And his body language, then that time I was remembering that he was asking Alan Border to be given the ball, right? And he was like, doesn't matter. So I think that has played out. He, apart from being like a very good bowler, I think he was a very good reader of body language. Yep. He set people up very well. I call him like a magician. He had his three-card trick. So in the movie Prestige, I think Christopher Nolan says that there are three parts to a magic trick, right? First is the pledge that he would say that I'll get you out. Two was the turn where he would like set you up with like sometimes a rubbish delivery. And then was the prestige where he actually foxed you and got you out. He had like a share of bunnies. All of the English cricket team and South African Daryl Cullinan come first to mind. Yeah. And the next thing is what a lot of other cricketers mentioned about Shane Warne. Well, even if he bowled a bad ball, even if he was taken apart for runs, he came back stronger next delivery and he just acted out as if it was part of his plan all along. And as a magician, I think it was all in the mind. So I think he's master magician, master tactician. Probably for his off-field transgressions, he is the best captain Australia never had. He showed his captaincy skills in Rajasthan Royals and how he motivated a team, which was the least experienced one, to win the first IPL, right? So... totally hats off. I haven't been a very big fan of Shane Warne. It's really sad to see him go, but his legacy will live on. Melbourne Cricket Ground, the Southern Stand, is going to be renamed as SK Warne Stand. And definitely he's going to be imprinted in memories of all cricket fans at that age.
No, and so, you know, I mean, I've played a bit of cricket, so I understand a little bit. It takes balls of steel to really flight the ball, right? And invite people to actually hit you.
Yeah.
Especially in a game situation, right? When you've been hit once or twice, I mean, it's just body language. You start bowling a lot flatter. And we see that in IPL also, right? I mean, a lot of people, in fact, a lot of spinners actually off late, I think, you know, they start bowling a lot flatter, wicket to wicket, almost to contain the person, right? But I never saw that with Shane Warne. Never, ever, right? I mean, whatever situation, the guy would just flight it up like a dolly, saying that, oh, you want to hit me more? Why don't you just step out a little more and hit me, right?
Yeah, almost like you could argue that he revived
spin bowling,
right? Like I particularly don't remember 80s and 90s, you know, We had so many, we didn't have that leg spinner. Has, in fact, people used to be very apologetic about even selecting leg spinners, right? They were considered huge liability because yeah. He kind of really revived it. I mean, you could probably think about an Abdul Qadir here, and then, you know, we have that one test sensation like Narendra Hirwani, who I don't think so, he really had a big googly, but he had one good leg spin. I think after that one memorable test in Chennai, I think he kind of faded into oblivion, right? So, Vaughan was like, you know, he revived a dying art, so as to speak. You know, today, if you really look at even IPL teams, right, like, they have like a plethora of leg spinners, right, in IPL and all that. So this is like just not about him being a great, you know, when, he's like an iconic inspiration for so many spinners and pretty good. And he was so great that, you know, actually there was one contemporary of him, another
Stuart McGill.
Stuart McGill was actually really good.
But he was awesome, actually.
I think he has a very good record, right? But
yeah.
You know, the sheer magician that Vaughan was, you know, it's quite unfortunate that he kind of paled in comparison, right? Compared to...
Stuart McGill was actually a very big turner as well, like Vaughan, right? And I think, you know, Nirav and I were discussing that probably he would have made it to any team in international cricket, except for Australia and maybe India, right?
So,
leg spin bowling is so hard, right? I mean, it's back of the arm. It's so difficult to control.
I think probably it's the most difficult.
Actually, your personal anecdote. At that age, I started bowling leg spin. I used to bowl, trying to bowl like Vaughan. I ended up being like straight one like Kumble. So that was my nickname in school. And Vaughan, during the pandemic, in association with some sponsor, etc., he was asking kids to bowl leg spin in their backyard, and he would give them coaching tips. And I just felt like, had someone told that in the 90s to me, because he said that move your arm at like a 9 o'clock angle and release it from there, that allows you to rip it more instead of being at 12 o'clock. So I absolutely felt that. And that's the only tweet of mine Shane Warne actually liked. I said, oh my God, I wish someone had pointed this out to me. So I retweeted Shane Warne's advice and he liked it. So that's, I don't know, my only fan moment with him.
No, there were, I think, a lot of tweets from plenty of people, right? Kevin Peterson, I think Sachin also. And I mean, for us 90s folks, you know, I mean, Sachin's battle with Shane Warne was another iconic memory, right? 97-98 tour, I think. So anyway, shucks. So moving on, fuel prices will increase next week as global crude oil prices continue to soar. Oil prices surged after Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24th, with the crude rising above $116 a barrel, while supply disruptions have hit global prices of essential goods. State oil companies have been told by the government that they need to price increase of 10-12 rupees per liter for petrol and diesel. Rahul Gandhi took the opportunity to slip in a dig at BJP, tweeting, "Quickly fill up your tanks. The Modi government's election offer is about to end." Well, this was expected, I suppose, and it's coming at perhaps an inopportune time, I would say, right? So what do you make of it, Nirav?
Okay, so I think, oil is a globally traded commodity and oil prices everywhere are going up. So I think unfortunately, we will have to live with it, right? What has happened is maybe that some sort of a sly dig is on point here, that because of the elections in 5 key states, including UP, India had kept oil prices flat. What will happen is that this pass-through will happen. India had done one very good thing. During COVID, when global oil prices collapsed, we actually raised our taxes, right? And recently, some states cut down their state tax a bit. And so excise duty is per liter. It's a flat fee per liter. But the state taxes are ad valorem. So it's a percentage of the price. So given that the oil prices have gone up, the tax collection by states do go up a bit more. So maybe we might see some states cut their tax a little bit. But I think the pass-through has to happen. Hopefully we get some sort of resolution, or US shale starts producing more or whatever. And OPEC maybe starts producing more, because they don't want the world to go in a recession. So we will see that as well. So I think this is, you have to live with it. It's a good thing. Another thing which might happen is we might see a gradual increase of like 1 rupee a week, what India done in 2014, that when diesel was heavily subsidized and we removed the subsidy in a gradual manner, maybe that happens. But yeah, I think it is what it is. We have to live with it. This is a side effect of global geopolitics. So yeah.
All right. In another consequence of the Russia-Ukraine war, Indian investors have lost more than Ukraine's GDP in the last 3 weeks as the stock market continues to crash. Indian stock markets logged their fourth consecutive week of losses as the Ukraine crisis worsens and the oil prices surge. Since February 16th, when the market cap of stock listed on BSE was at 2.6 crore, Indian markets have seen a wealth erosion of about 15 lakh crores, which is more than the GDP of Ukraine. So Nirav, what do you think? I mean, you think that, you know, it will worsen going further, or it's a bit of an overreaction? What do you think?
I think, see, a couple of things is, while you might want to say it, it's an overreaction, I think this is the start of the war, and we will see probably a huge variance of outcomes, as I mentioned earlier, right? We don't really know what affects what and what chain reaction is. So I don't want to make any kind of big statements over here that, oh, this is a dip and buy, this is not investment advice. But if I want to point out two positive things which might happen, Russia is a big part of an equity index, and a part of a very big part of a global bond index. So there is Morgan Stanley equity index, MSCI, and Russia is a big part of the emerging market index. A lot of Western pension funds or like ETFs are linked to that. Russia is also very about has 4% weight in like a JP Morgan emerging market bond fund, which India is trying to get into, right? And so if these two things happen and Russia has sanctions, we might actually see some of the marginal new money get allocated to India, right? So again, Indian economy, some of it gets affected by oil, and higher oil prices is going to hurt consumption or like auto sales, two-wheeler sales, etc. Some of it is probably immune from oil, which is like software services like Infosys, TCS, or like Indian domestic banks, which focus on domestic economy, right? So what I would say is, yes, I think the market has crashed. It has crashed for a reason. You look at in global comparison, it's kind of in line. India is not like underperformed massively. And till we see some sort of resolution, I don't think that we see like a very quick rebound, but we could see some positives just beyond the horizon, right? So I think that is probably somewhere there in the pipeline. And this should probably help us. So that's all I can say. It's I would not say that don't panic and sell. That's all. If you're holding on, just hold on. And that's all. Yeah. And this is not investment advice. Bharat Vartha is not giving you any investment advice.
Yeah, not investment advice for sure. But I think the greatest gains are by staying invested in the market, right? Especially at these sort of ups and downs. And all right, on that mildly optimistic note, we're going to end the podcast for today. Thank you so much for logging in, and we'll bring you more news and updates next week. So from Nirav, Prasanna, and myself, thank you so much again, and stay safe, take care, and see you next week.